This is a unique occasion because I'm sharing a podium with two people who are very dear to me, and I never thought we would be in this kind of a situation together. First of all, the person who has departed the podium, Dr. DeCatanzaro, a person to whom I wish to pay most excellent tribute as a pastor and teacher, and as one of the few truly charitable persons whom I've ever met. Secondly, it's a joy to share the podium with your last speaker, Dottie Faber. I'm the pot kettle section of the Mon Kettle Show. I don't know where there would be an occasion where I could think of anything more appropriate to say about Dottie than the fact that I am not acquainted with anybody who is a greater mother confessor to more priests who oppose ordination of women. There is a kind of a spirit that goes about the church when you've got a problem to solve in your parish, call Dottie. She'll have some thoughts on it. And believe me, I've availed myself of that occasion many, many times. Dr. DeCatanzaro said something tonight which struck me. He reminded us that in Canada there is a conscience clause. In the Episcopal Church of the United States of America, called PCUSA, there is no conscience clause. The conscience is in the mind and the heart and the spirit of those priests and people who will not give in. I stand before you as a priest who is inhibited, deposed, and seceded. A great trisagion of something. And as I boarded an airplane a month or so ago, I thought of the matter of conscience, the absence of a conscience clause in the church. And I sped on my way eastward. I thought that there is a conscience in the church. It does exist in a person who is truly trying to be a pastor, who paid my way there, who talked to me charitably as a priest, and who listened to what I had to say. If he's in this room this evening, I wish to thank him for that exercise of conscience which he displayed towards me. In our conversations, we talked about the condition of our church. It is unnecessary to recount those aspects of the condition of our church which cause us difficulty, because that has taken place last night and today. What we are about this evening is to turn our gaze away from looking at the difficulties of Minneapolis and the condition of the church, and to turn our gaze upon the future, the vision of a deliverance from the condition in which we find ourselves. It is very easy for us to become blackmailed and stultified by what has happened in the past. I wish to assure you that at the bottom of the spirit of progress towards the vision of the future for the continuing church is a sense of courage to face what must be faced. I'm reminded of an allegory taken out of long ago, 14th century Europe, the time of the great bubonic plagues. It's an allegory of two knights who meet on the outside of Paris, one black, one white. The black knight is pestilence, from the four horsemen of the apocalypse. And when the two knights meet, the white knight asks Pestilence why he is going to the city of Paris, and he says, I'm going to take 10,000 lives. And the white knight says, please do not do that. I will make you an agreement. I will pay you money. Take only 5,000 lives. And so the money is paid. And Pestilence sweeps into the city of Paris and takes 10,000 lives. And he meets the great white knight returning from his path of destruction and disease. And the white knight is enraged. And he says, Pestilence, you agreed with me for 5,000 lives, but you took 10,000. You have violated the agreement. And Pestilence said, nay, it was not I who violated the agreement. I took only 5,000 lives. It was my companion, Fear. He took the rest. Fear is the greatest problem we face in our present crisis in the church. Fear for our present and fear for the future. And most notably, this fear is one shared by the clergy. And the next few remarks I would like to make, I would like to address to the clergy. We are ordained for the purpose of leading, not following. We follow no one except our Lord. We lead the people of God fearlessly. That is our duty, our vocation. To be afraid is to fail to fulfill the logical implications of what we are called and ordained to do. I have thought and prayed much about this over past weeks and months. The fear which besets us freezes us and locks us into a position and keeps us from surging forward to do what we must do in accordance with God's will and plan. It is our fear that we must overcome before we can face the future positively and with a sense of reliance that God will indeed provide for us. What do I have in mind for the future if we fearlessly face the coming days and months? First of all, the solution to the most basic aspect of our problem, the problem of theological education. The speakers last night and today have told you that the basis of our predicament is the seminaries and the failure of the seminaries to produce priests who truly believe the faith. Therefore, I see as a part of our immediate vision the establishment of a new theological seminary which will train men for the future, and they will give us the education of the men we need to lead us fearlessly into the future of our practice of the faith. Already, plans are going forward in the San Francisco Bay Area, that great center of humanism and anti-religion, for the foundation of a great theological seminary based in the chapel of St. Joseph of Arimathea. Isn't that interesting? Which will be the basis for the theological education, we hope, of men for the continuing church. Great need for the future is to begin a process of education not only of men for the diaconate and priesthood, but of the education of the laity as to what the problem in the church really is. Because as I have traveled about recently trying to tell people of our present situation in the church, I have discovered unbelievable lack of knowledge of what is really happening. It is necessary for us to establish some central clearinghouse for information and for the exchange of legal information so that priests, vestries, and parishes may fearlessly defend themselves, if necessary, in the civil courts against autocratic bishops. Beyond that, it is necessary for us as a part of this vision to establish a speaker's bureau with people trained to go into parishes and to contact people and to tell them the truth. We cannot rely upon the media, whether secular or ecclesiastical, to tell the truth. We must go as Christ taught us to go, two by two, out before him, and to tell people what they need to hear in the way of the truth. How do we conduct an every member canvass? We do not conduct an every member canvass by appealing to the local radio station or newspaper or by mailers. We send canvassers out to make a personal contact with the people of God and to assure them of God's love and to assure them of the love of their fellow parishioners. That is how they respond. And that is what we must do. We must canvass this church with the truth by personal contact. And that involves sacrifice on your part, the sacrifice of your time, your treasure, your talent, because you have the talent to do this, and you are needed. The next great aspect of the vision for the future is to seek ways of making people realize that they must make a change and to instruct them to do it in the right way. And this is the most difficult aspect of all, because many do not want to make a change. And the basic process by which this is overcome is by the fearless preaching of the preacher who does not shirk his responsibility to tell the people what they must do. One of the interesting aspects of history is that Nicholas Ridley, one of the great martyrs of Anglicanism, was one of the most fearless preachers. And in the confused reign of King Edward VI, he did not fail to preach what was necessary, even though there might have been objection to what he was saying, most notably concern to the poor. The martyrs of the church and the martyrs of Anglicanism have fearlessly preached what the people needed to hear. And this the clergy must do. But mincing from the pulpit is not a way to lead fearlessly. I believe that as a part of the consideration of our vision of the future, we are subject to the temptation of putting too much emphasis upon when we are going to consecrate bishops. Over and over I hear this question presented to me. When do we consecrate bishops? When do we find bishops who will give us the apostolic succession? When do we reach bishops who will keep us in communion with the Catholic Church? Give us bishops now and ask us to sacrifice later. What I have to say to you tonight is sacrifice now and worry about bishops later. Because after all, if we are to expect bishops to come forth to lead us, we must be found worthy as stewards. Remember what the apostle tells us about stewards. Moreover, it is necessary that they be found worthy. If we are to be worthy recipients of the episcopal leadership which we desire, we must present ourselves honestly and to demonstrate that we deserve to be led. And we must be willing and able to sacrifice ourselves momentarily in the interim in order to achieve this goal. I cannot stand before you tonight and tell you that I think that we have all the answers to all of the problems. I stand before you as a person who appeals to the conscience of those bishops who would lead us. But we must also be, and I must also be, worthy priest of a congregation ever increasingly loyal. Each day brings its own challenge, its own difficulty. But somehow, as each day passes, I become less concerned, less afraid for the future. One day, recently, I was thinking of the song from that wonderful Rodgers and Hammerstein musical, The King and I. I whistle a happy tune so they won't know I'm afraid. But that is not a song of fear. It's a song of determination and an unwillingness to give in, and with a firm conviction, which Anna obviously had and demonstrated. I ask all of you tonight to turn your back upon the awfulness of our recent past, to turn your gaze fearlessly to the future, and to ask God to give us now and each day His power and strength to face what we have to face. Surely He will not fail us.